So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Well, just let me say that this is Mr. McMahon's idea of conservative, but it's not mine. And I know that all you people are not watching this pay-per-view to see conservative. So after my conversation with Mr. McMahon, I thought about what he said, and then I thought I have ideas of my own. This is a World Wrestling Federation pay-per-view, and as they say, anything can happen. And this is live TV. And there ain't a damn thing Vince can do about this.
Oh! Now that is a bikini. Good God.
There goes my shirt up over my.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting back again
here
for another discussion.
One more, just one last one.
What do you mean one last one? Do you have news?
Never know. No, oh. No news. But you never know.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What would the official Wei Chung Ting fighter jersey look like? How would you differentiate yours from the pack?
It'd probably be the colors of China. It's probably what they listed as.
And it wouldn't be listed as Wei Ting.
No.
Too many people would recognize that.
Be my full name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People might buy that knowing who it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Unlike Timothy Grant or Thomas Lawler or Gilbert Melendez.
Oh, God. Yeah, John and I, right before we're recording this, we're just looking through all that Reebok site with all the UFC official jerseys. And just what a debacle.
The homogenization of the UFC fighters, for the most part.
Oh, man.
Like, yeah. Robots, for the most part, are what some of these fighters are going to resemble coming into the cage. The vast majority.
I think fighters already kind of suffer from that, you know, in that none of their tights are really anything that special. But there are certain guys that you do recognize with signature tights. People like Anderson Silva with his signature yellow. Or Mirko Krokop, you know, with the Croatian flag.
Or Dennis Hallman.
Yeah.
With his barely covering...
Banana hammock.
Yes.
But now, everybody's just going to have black tights. And imagine, like, professional wrestling, where you just had the WWE with no outfits and just black tights.
The entire UFC is now going to be the Young Lions of New Japan Pro Wrestling. They're all going to be given Boston Crabs. And then, eventually, they'll be given... knee pads.
But I'll bet you if the Young Lions had their names on the backs, they'd probably be spelled right and not messed up. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, if you go on the website here, just how many screw-ups. By the time you listen to this, they might have changed some of these, but just what a... You wouldn't expect this level of unprofessionalism from the UFC nor Reebok.
Some of the early highlights have been, as we mentioned, Gilbert Melendez. It is a tough name to nail
Gibbler,
down.
Yeah.
Gib. Hey, Gib. The other being Jacare Souza and Ronaldo in quotations. That's what his friends call him.
Yeah.
Ronaldo. Born a guy who probably assumed, it's a long form of Jack.
It would be like if Dan Lavransky had a shirt and we had mouth.
Dan Lavransky.
Quote Dan Lavransky.
Did you watch any of the fashion show on Tuesday morning?
I caught bits and pieces.
Dude, this was the ultimate fashion show for you. Because we had all these fighters who were coming out like this was the newest unveiling of American Gladiators with Team World being represented. And it was all done to dubstep.
Oh, God. Just everything about it just screams, you know.
Out of touch with their audience.
Like a bunch of suits in a market research warehouse trying to think of what the kids would like. And just everything about it, it just it's terrible.
So some very unhappy fighters with this Reebok announcement because the the sacrifice in artistic presentation is certainly not being supplemented by financial gain for the vast majority of these fighters, at least in the short term.
Yeah, and that would be one thing, you know. I do understand why the UFC would want to do something like that to make it seem more like... Really, it's to capitalize on, you know, the jersey trend of other sports, but... I feel like there's a lot more self-expression when you buy a Raptors jersey or something else versus, you know, you buy this George St. Pierre jersey. It looks exactly like, you know...
The Timothy Grant jersey, another famous Canadian.
Timothy Grant or Bruno Mesquita or Brian Barberina. It looks like just like any of their jerseys. It's terrible and it's lazy.
Timothy Grant is how Timothy TJ Grant is Timothy being marketed, TJ. Who is not even fighting any longer and has moved to Saskatchewan, where he is doing mining now.
Mm.
But he does now have an official apparel deal with Reebok. Mm. So maybe for Christmas I will get you the Timothy Grant jersey.
That'd be a big waste.
So if you could buy a Giblet one, if some of those somehow made its way to the market, oh, those would be collector's items.
I would feel really guilty if you even got that as a joke gift, because these things are $95.
They're not cheap.
American.
Those are just the jerseys, correct? Not even the fighter kit.
What the hell is a kit? What's in the kit?
The kit is you get all this apparel that your fighter will be wearing, and you can... And the fighters do get a percentage of that.
What's included in the kit?
I can't even say. You're on the website. You might have
trying to look.
Is there a category that says kit?
There's shoes. I mean, they're regular CrossFit shoes. They don't really say.
Are those Brian Barberina shoes?
I don't believe so.
I want Brian Barberina shoes for Christmas.
No, I don't think any of them have their names on it. They're just regular CrossFit shoes that are for some reason in these. Because UFC fighters, they wear shoes, right? They, you know.
That's huge.
I don't. It's so lame. Very, very lame. I'd take an Ambrose Asylum shirt over these any day.
Unhinged and on the fringe.
Yes.
At least they are getting, I mean, one thing you can say about WWE is that they do market personalities that I feel a much further step forward than this incarnation of athlete promotion that the UFC is presenting, at least on day one of this Reebok deal, taking full visual effect for everybody to absorb. But today, we're going to go back to a much more innocent time in both mixed martial arts and professional wrestling. It was the summer of 1998. And what a summer it was, Wei. If you were to look at a certain several-month period where you could say was the peak of the Monday Night Wrestling War, I think the summer of 1998 was a summer where both companies did extraordinary business, both at live events, on television, and in particular on pay-per-view. The WWF was... promoting the SummerSlam event, which would end up being the most purchased SummerSlam ever. That same summer, WCW had their Bash at the Beach show with Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman involved, which would be their second highest pay-per-view ever. I mean, things were, from a pure numbers standpoint, phenomenal in this summer, even if you could see a lot of the problems in WCW coming to the forefront. Business was on fire for both promotions during this summer.
It's funny how... the best business that the company does kind of coincides with very unmemorable, bad wrestling matches. You know what I mean?
This show, if you go back and simply watch it, which we have done over the past week, and you're watching this with 2015 eyes, there's nothing stellar about this show. I will go so far as to say. However, it is the latest example of when characters are connecting and your public is engaged with your product.
And wrestling was just hot.
Super hot. This show did a 0.9 buy rate, which was, forget about, just, it beat the prior month's pay-per-view, which was the infamous King of the Ring with the Hell in a Cell. This was one of the biggest B shows that WWF had done up to that point, and beat WrestleMania of the prior year in 1997. Like, this was a very successful show when I was looking up the business it did. In Fresno, California, at the Celland Arena. And this was largely, like, you weren't getting a giant culmination of anything. This was just a stopgap before SummerSlam, and you had some incredibly hot characters, and that had permeated down, where it was just a hot product with the fallout of WrestleMania that year, which had really spiked business with Tyson coming in and the emergence of so many new and fresh characters led by Steve Austin. And it translated to business. And the idea that, you know, hot wrestling matches are the be-all and end-all. I mean, this is just the latest example that it's anything but.
Yeah, I do wonder if there were some classic matches. I think they'd do even better, but definitely this was a character-driven product at this time.
Was this the first time you had ever watched Fully Loaded in 1998?
Yes.
Oh, so this was first viewing for you.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
my last.
You may never be fully loaded again, at least for the 1998 version. Mm-hmm. This show was largely built around, of course, the main event, and all summer long, the big tease was if The Undertaker and Kane were in cahoots. But I would say, you know, watching the product at this time, the second most pushed thing on this show was the idea of this bikini contest. I mean, Sable and Jacqueline were pushed like the second main event of this show with the idea of, oh my God, maybe you'll see tits on this show. And they certainly, pardon the pun, teased this as heavily as possible right from the get-go of this show. I mean, I don't want, like, Sable's quarter hours during this time, I mean, there was a time when just teasing skin on the show was so intriguing to their audience. And she was a giant mover. And they would still, like, kind of go with this model until nobody cared any longer about bikini contests on Raw. We'd see it on Impact, but there was a time that it was certainly a big mover, and this was the case in mid-98.
This was at a time where internet speeds weren't really that fast.
Oh, the idea of getting this on regular, traditional pay-per-view and...
Well, I'm talking about the appeal of seeing a naked woman, perhaps, on TV.
Yeah, it wasn't as accessible on the internet.
Yeah.
Not everyone was hooked up.
There were no tube sites back then at all. So this, you know, this might have been the only time you would get to see, a naked woman without having to pay for a porn.
Yeah, and this, they'd come close on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were... They did deliver, I guess, if you had paid for this pay-per-view.
Definitely.
With this in mind. I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say that this was the second biggest thing they promoted on this show going in.
And I don't think it's a stretch to say that this bikini contest is the only memorable thing coming out of this show.
We were talking this past Monday with our producer, Sarge, right before Review of Raw. And we were talking about this review. And believe me, he's not a super big wrestling fan. But when we mentioned what was on this show, he instantly remembered this iconic shot of Sable's boobs.
Yep.
I mean, everyone remembers it.
Handprints on the boobs. Yes, yeah. It's an iconic Attitude Era.
Absolutely. Visual. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So Jerry Lawler starts off this show in maybe one of the creepier Jerry Lawler segments he has ever engaged in, which covers lots of ground. He is invited into Sable's dressing room for some last words, the go-home promo for the bikini contest. And there was a brief description of the bikini for later on, and Sable says she's going to give Jerry Lawler a tease. And she goes behind a silhouette wall and takes her top off and instructs Jerry Lawler to come look at Jerry Lawler some 14 years before he actually did, nearly had a heart attack seeing these boobs. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. Like, he was about to pass out
Yeah,
from tits.
He lost it. Couldn't believe it.
Well, I don't think he did lose it. In fact, he later said that he was a... We'll get into it later. This was so creepy on many levels. I don't doubt that this probably aired on the Sunday Night Heat just to drive those last-minute pay-per-view buys. I think the fact that this show did as many buys as it did, you can certainly look at a lot of factors. This Sable tease, I totally believe, was a contributing factor.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Because this was not a gigantic pay-per-view, but you had a lot of factors going for it, and this was certainly one of the driving forces. The idea that you might see boobs on this pay-per-view.
The payoff, the basically years-long build of the possibility of seeing Sable naked was built, I'd say, really well throughout the course of the year, culminating ultimately in the Playboy pictorial.
It was like the traditional build of like a babyface to get his big payoff at WrestleMania winning the title. For Sable, it was being in Playboy and making a ton of money.
Yeah.
So, I don't doubt she made more for that first Playboy magazine than some main eventers at WrestleMania have. I'm sure it was a six-figure payoff.
I'm sure, sure. And I'm sure the company made a lot along with her. But, you know, you give a little first. You give maybe, you know, just a regular standard bikini. Oh, wow, I can't believe it. Then you kind of show more and more, and ultimately, you know, I guess you overexpose.
How often do we talk about the fact they don't use their history enough to push long-term builds? And here, during the video of building this up, they went back to the Slammy Awards from 1997 to emphasize that that bikini was going to look like an evening gown in comparison.
Yeah. It's amazing.
This really was the main event of the show, as we discussed.
Definitely.
The opening video was the summer-long mystery of The Undertaker and Kane, if they were in cahoots together, which was also the word of the summer of 98 on WWF programming. Cahoots. Have you ever been in cahoots with someone?
Probably not described like that, but...
And this tied in everything together because we knew we were getting Steve Austin and The Undertaker at SummerSlam. There was this tension between the two. They had to tag tonight. And if The Undertaker and Kane were working together, it had repercussions on Austin, on Vince McMahon, and Mankind. And that tonight, they said, questions will be answered, but will the answers become questions?
Right.
Ooh.
Yep. So
some deep stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Val Venus is out, and...
His pay-per-view debut.
This was his pay-per-view debut.
That's what they mentioned, yeah.
He comes out, and I thought with a name like Fully Loaded, this would be his easiest promo material possible. Val Venus, for those that did not watch at the time, the porn star-turned-wrestler, mm-hmm. his character at least, would come out, and it was always just a play on words to emphasize him having an erection or going further and finishing. And... his words here were simply...
what this writing team definitely excels at.
They were very good at this time. Mm-hmm. This was the Vince Russo, Ed Ferrara era of writing Raw, of course, with Vince McMahon as the ultimate editor. And he simply said, California, here I come. And he goes to take off his trunks. We were almost going to get more nudity on this show. But he was interrupted by Tennessee Lee, who was bringing out Jeff Jarrett, who had Southern Justice in his corner, the former Godwins, and Val Venus and Jeff Jarrett, a pairing that I could definitely foresee being a future Global Force Wrestling main event.
Southern Justice? You think?
No. Val Venus and Jeff Jarrett.
Oh. Yeah?
Always possible.
Sure.
I mean, Val Venus, he's not that far removed from that last TNA run, which was pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
Jarrett, and he comes out, and then he's followed by Kai and Tai, who's out, but Jimmy Corderas, laying down the law, sends Kai and Tai and Southern Justice to the back, but Yamaguchi-san remains out to join commentary with his Hideo Nomo baseball hat, which really took me back. Remember the phenomenon that was Hideo Nomo?
Yeah, I do.
On the LA Dodgers. This was at the time when Val Venus had recently premiered one of his many videos, this one involving Yamaguchi-san's wife. Feel we're going backwards here, because mm-hmm. if you want to see how this one ultimately peaks and ends up getting cut off, we do review the two-episode arc to the climax of this particular angle involving Yamaguchi-san, Kai and Tai, and Val Venus. I will say Yamaguchi-san right near the bottom of guest commentators. I thought he was pretty terrible.
He was awful. I thought, he just wasn't very good with any lines and just seemed quiet most of the time when he wasn't really giving any material.
He felt very uncomfortable. Like, it almost felt like he was literally talking about an actual event in his life involving his wife cheating on him and revealing this via video.
Mm.
And constantly just saying that they had a big surprise in store for Val Venus tomorrow night on Raw. That was the big push here. I think TNA was taking notes here. Like, oh, they pay, and then we'll sell them on the free show. Hmm. Not a great match here between these two. There was a chop exchange, and then a DDT delivered to Venus, which allowed Jim Ross to note that it would make anyone limp. There was a fisherman suplex to Jarrett for a two count as Venus made his comeback. Jarrett hit a high cross for a two count, and then Venus misses him in the corner. And then Jarrett is knocked into the referee. Tennessee Lee crotches Val Venus, and then Jarrett hits a superplex. Then the figure four is countered with an inside cradle, and then Jarrett is sent into Tennessee Lee, who is knocked off the apron, and Venus gets a roll-up for the win at 7 minutes, 51 seconds, and Venus tells Yamaguchi-san to stand up, realizing that he already is standing up. A short joke that was literally just used weeks ago on Jamie Noble, so at least they like to recycle their short jokes. And says his wife said he will never measure up to Val Venus. And yes, this was his pay-per-view debut, and he remained undefeated at this point in his WWF run.
It seemed like a character that was definitely very over at the time and really coincided with the whole new tone of the Attitude Era.
But one that would certainly not sustain itself.
Yeah.
They showed shots outside of the Hart home in Calgary, simply identified as Stu Hart's home on the graphic. And there's a sign in the crowd that read, Lawler killed Kaufman. So still mysteries amidst his death in 1998. D'Lo Brown, who had just won the European title, probably his most famous run in wrestling history, that European title run, defeating Triple H on the Raw prior, and then was set to take on X-Pac here in a non-title match. And the Godfather is in the corner of D'Lo, while China is in the corner of X-Pac. And given their back and forth over the last month, I mean, this is kind of
the happier times.
A callback to, yes, a more stable relationship between the two. Mm-hmm. There was a spinning heel kick by D'Lo, and an X-Pac ran into the turnbuckle crotch first as Brown got the advantage. I thought China was maybe the most over performer here. The crowd was constantly chanting for her throughout this, and this was before China had really gotten into that territory where she was getting involved in matches and getting pushed. I mean, she was just kind of the muscle of DX and Triple H.
Didn't really speak.
No, she was a mute at the time. Brown applies a rear chin lock, attacks X-Pac with chops, and then is run chest first into the corner. And of course, D'Lo was doing the chest protector gimmick at this time, and is selling the pectoral injury. X-Pac misses a spinning heel kick. Brown then misses a moonsault from the top. His chest is hurt as X-Pac makes the comeback, Bronco Buster, and then the Godfather hits him from the apron. X-Pac knocks him down, turns around, and gets hit with the Sky High, and Brown pins X-Pac at 8:27, and China livid at this blatant disregard of the rules and her guy losing to D'Lo Brown in this non-title match.
This was pretty much a Raw level quality match you'd see today. And again, every time we go back to watch a Shawn Waltman match, especially here with D'Lo, I don't think that, you know, they're never really bad matches, but they're just nothing special.
Yeah, it was very telling the rate at which the in-ring has progressed from this period of time, which was a very romanticized period in wrestling. But if you were like today's audience watching this, mm-hmm. I mean, you can't even compare the quality of wrestling you get on a weekly basis from WWE compared to this. Edge is shown in the crowd, another mute. And then Kevin Kelly.
And that was his push at the time.
Just hanging out, hey, checking things out, yeah, and not wearing shirts.
Hey, there's Edge. That's it.
Kevin Kelly has breaking news backstage. The Undertaker has not yet arrived at the building for their main event. And Tom Pritchard, wearing a 1998 god-awful shirt.
Didn't notice. What was he wearing?
Do you want to see this?
Was it as ugly as these Reebok shirts?
No, this was better, I think. This was a...
Thomas Pritchard?
This was a Thomas Pritchard with his...
Oh my God. What is that?
And look at that goatee on Double K.
Kevin Kelly, yeah. Tom Pritchard looks like he's wearing some type of... Like, it looks like some type of a solar flare, like in space, you know?
It's like a meteor shower just went off on his shirt. There you go. Keyword WWF to log on to their website for all their breaking news. Embracing the internet.
Keyword?
Yeah, you had to have a keyword. That's what it said on the backdrop there.
Keyword WWF? Like, you mean like...
This was on AOL. You needed keywords.
Oh, keywords. Okay, so this was even before Yahoo.
I think so.
Wow.
This was even pre me having the internet, so this was a brand new medium. Who thought this would take off? This was their transition from the hotline. Then they say the Taker has a stellar attendance record, and Pritchard believes he will be here. And Ross then gives us the backstage news, the information that the Undertaker has a rep for always being early to shows. So this is very against character for the Undertaker. Bradshaw and Terry Funk are then interviewed in the back, and Terry Funk announces this is going to be his last match for a while. This wasn't a full-fledged Terry Funk retirement. It was a Terry Funk semi-retirement, which was amazing. This was in 1998.
What was the backstory here?
He was legitimately looking just to take time off, and would take time off after
this. But was he looking to leave the WWE at the time, or just simply take a hiatus from the company?
I think it was largely just to take a hiatus, and they just parted ways, and he would not come back to the company until...
2005?
2006, for that second one-night stand show. So he, to his word, took some time off to recharge those batteries. And Bradshaw got swerved here.
How so?
Bradshaw was his tag partner, and he hadn't been given the heads up by Terry Funk, and finds out during a live interview.
This is like an episode of Swerved.
This was Swerved, 1998 version, with Bradshaw being swerved. Funk says he's going to take about 6 months off, and Bradshaw's pissed and walks off.
Yeah, this was Bradshaw.
This was post-New Blackjacks.
Right.
So he had nothing going for him. So he was probably legitimately pissed here. Terry Funk leaving. What the hell was he going to do?
Yeah.
Maybe Bradshaw was given a hint at his opponent tonight.
Maybe.
Farouk.
Maybe. But Bradshaw, this guy just seemed lost for years, especially early on, you know, with a variety of gimmicks and nothing sticking.
Yeah, this guy was still wearing his blackjack trunks in 1998. I mean, nothing says just no one cares than you're wearing your outdated gimmick trunks. You're not even going to update your look to reflect what you're doing now.
Really just have Reebok on those trunks.
Yes, Jonathan Layfield.
Yeah.
Bradshaw and Terry Funk versus Scorpio and Farouk.
Mm-hmm.
How jazzed were you when you saw this was on the lineup?
Scorpio and Farouk? Not jazzed at all. I was more excited that we were going to get the Battle of the Funks here. Flash and Terry.
Oh, that's right. What a dream match after all this time.
Funk and Funk.
They mentioned here in passing that Bradshaw and Scorpio had recently qualified for the Brawl for All tournament. I don't know what that entailed. Probably just, hey, can you do this? Sure, you've qualified. I don't think there was a rigorous screening process of who would be eligible for the Brawl for All.
Probably not, no.
There was a Hurricane Rana from Scorpio to Bradshaw in this, and then led to the Battle of the Future APA. There was a shoulder block off the top by Bradshaw, getting a two count, and then tagging in Terry Funk. Bradshaw came off the top, Farouk power slammed him. Bunch of power spots here from Ron Simmons. We saw this like acai Vader bomb is best I can describe by Terry Funk to the floor.
Yeah, some type of springboard splash deal. Not very graceful, but no. I'd say impressive for Funk's age at the time.
Yes. Scorpio then hit this twisting splash off the top after Farouk runs in and attacks Funk. The crowd started chanting boring, and to his credit, Jim Ross acknowledging this. It was not exactly noticeable, but enough that Jim Ross was not going to ignore it. Scorpio hit a scoop slam and a 450 splash onto Bradshaw. As Bradshaw and Farouk fought on the floor, and he hit the 450 onto Terry Funk, pinning him at 650. And then Bradshaw yells at Terry Funk after the match, yelling, "This is bullshit!" And then attacks Terry Funk with a lariat, then proceeds to attack Scorpio with a clothesline from hell on the floor, rotating him in midair, and then takes a chair, attacking Farouk, and leaves them all laying. So at least some focus on Bradshaw as he would go into the Brawl for All with some steam from laying out these three.
Yeah, I guess so. Just, you know, a match with two teams that were kind of thrown together without any real issue. Match wasn't that good. No real story as far as I could tell. So, you know. Did he go on to form a team with Farouk shortly after this?
They wouldn't be put together until, I'll say, late 98, early 99. As the, well, it was with the ministry where they were put together as the Acolytes.
Now, where was Farouk at here? Because he, I mean, as somebody who used to lead the Nation of Domination.
He had been kicked out of the Nation and was just in no man's land at this point.
He seemed completely just dropped down on the card here.
They were two guys that were lost by the end of 98, and they got paired together. They were buddies and caught way more of a run out of that. And I mean, the Acolytes, what a goofy name with the paint on their chest. I mean, it just looked like another dead end gimmick for them. And they turned it into something that worked and that, you know, largely was more pretty memorable run for both.
Was more true to their personalities.
Yes. Too. Oh, then we got the first Battle of the Bulls. Vader and Mark Henry. Mark Henry being one of I know I said the only person on this show. We had Kane and Mark Henry, two men who were on Raw this past Monday and were also part of Fully Loaded 98. And Vader, part of last week's Impact.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, both men still very relevant in the scene.
Boy, I'll say, Vader, did you watch that match with Bram last week?
I watched bits of it, yeah.
This will be on my worst of list for the end of the year, I think. That was a horrendous match.
We saw Vader years ago at a Wrestle Reunion show, remember?
Yes, here in Toronto.
He definitely has an appeal. Just to see him come out in costume and to do his mannerisms, I think there's a lot of appeal there. You can't expect the Vader of 98.
Vader has had some embarrassing moments over the last decade. Do you remember in 2005 when he made that return on Raw and he came down and I can't even remember who he ran into someone and then he lost his balance and fell over.
Oh, I don't remember.
It was
like as he was going for the bomb, Vader bomb?
No, he was running down to ringside. I almost want to pull this. Do you want to see this?
Not really, but
then,
okay.
Okay. I think.
Yeah, pull it up.
Vader falls Raw. I'm hoping we find this. First thing that comes up, Vader falls. Oh, he was getting off the ring.
Who's that?
That's Jonathan Coachman. Okay. Yeah, this wasn't.
Oh.
Yeah, it was sad more than anything. Vader was always one of my favorites. In WCW in the 90s, I loved Vader. I thought he was great. And Vader he had a terrible WWF run. And unfortunately, not always booked the best. But here we had Vader and Mark Henry. Ross doesn't think this one's going to go long. Crowd was hot for Vader, chanting his name. This was coming after a very bizarre loss that Vader suffered at, I believe, the May pay-per-view, which he did the infamous, I'm just a fat piece of shit. That was his post-fight promo, which was, there's one for a future UFC promo. If you want to steal ideas, just lamented that he was just a fat piece of shit. So this is his redemption. The Battle of the Bulls. He ran into a scoop slam where Henry nearly lost him, so then tried again and did hit it as Vader then went to the floor. There was a double sledge to the back of Vader, then a jumping elbow drop and leg drop by Henry. Sunset flip, Vader just jumps up and lands on him, and Ross notes, no finesse in this match. No, there was not. Vader avalanched him in the corner, sent him to the floor, and then Henry was tossed into the steps. There was a splash off the second turnbuckle, which Henry kicked out of, but then Henry caught him, hitting a power slam and a mid-ring splash, and pinned Vader in 5 minutes and 4 seconds.
The finish kind of came out of nowhere, and I think this crowd was much more attached to Vader than, you know, than Mark Henry, it seemed like they were trying to push again here. And it's interesting to see this match because, you know, Vader undeniably has like a really unique charisma in ring and a real crazy intensity that just, especially with that outfit, I think, you know, he'll always be very memorable. But Mark Henry at this time was just this bland guy in his mid-20s lacking in character. This was even before Sexual Chocolate. But it's funny because I think in recent years, Mark Henry has kind of developed a more aggressive, you know, beast-like, charismatic character, not unlike Vader at this point in time.
To Mark Henry's credit, I feel the last 4 years, and a lot of this has been they have not really given him a whole lot, but when they put the title on him, the promo with John Cena to set up their match, I mean, I think that that part, Mark Henry is going to be remembered for a lot more than all the horrible angles he was a part. That's certainly a part of Mark Henry that you can't necessarily forget.
And it's too bad that it took him that long to develop that character, but because by the time he did find it, he was already so overexposed as this mid-carder, you know, for life.
But it's certainly incredible to go back to this show, and if you were to show somebody this show and say, hey, come 2015, what guy on this roster would still be working every week? I mean, Kane and Mark Henry would be quite near the bottom of my list of guys that would be sticking around and uninterrupted as well. I mean, outside of injuries to Mark Henry. Yeah. And Kane has largely been a constant other than the odd injury for him as well.
And a vacation to and Hawaii.
Well, very much deserved. Yeah. Come on. Then we had an update again from Kevin Kelly and Pritchard backstage saying that the cameras are searching for The Undertaker and searching the city. They've sent out an APB on The Undertaker to go find him. There should have been vignettes all show long going throughout Fresno, searching bars, cemeteries.
Funeral homes, yeah.
Kane and Mankind, along with Paul Bearer, come out. And Bearer says that The Undertaker doesn't want to wrestle Kane because he wants to stay in one piece for SummerSlam, and he's a coward. And Austin is simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. This leads to the New Age Outlaws coming out, who, interestingly enough, were not booked on this show for a match. And they said, you think you're going to have your way with the Cold One? The Cold One being Stone Cold.
Oh.
Okay. You know, how he's affectionately referred to. That would be his Reebok nickname. The Cold One.
The Cold One.
Steven Williams. And they issue a challenge for Raw tomorrow for the tag titles. And then they attacked them. Officials stormed the ring to break it up. And then we got a video for the next match where we were starting off Hawk's personal issues, where he was mysteriously disappearing during key moments when Animal needed help. And this had caused a feud here with the Disciples of Apocalypse when they were double-teaming Animal on a prior edition of Raw, and Paul Ellering, the longtime manager of the Road Warriors, had now aligned himself with Skull and 8-Ball. And they were about to run over Animal with a motorcycle. They were going to just run him over.
Like, this was not even, you know, backstage. It wasn't on a street. This was in the middle of the entrance ramp. So all of a sudden, I don't even know how you would run over somebody with a motorcycle. You can do it, but he didn't even have that much, like, distance. Like, they were threatening this man in front of 15,000 people was going to run over this large dude with a motorcycle.
Well, ridiculous. Thankfully, Hawk ran down at just the right time to stop this near death to Animal.
Imagine if he didn't run out.
And that'd be the ultimate cue to miss.
This man just, like, ran over this person and nobody stopped him.
That brought us to DOA. Against LOD 2000. This was a god-awful match. Paul Ellering was sporting goggles in 98, which was a bit of a look in 98 for some, but these
like
were...
They're like motorcycle goggles.
Yes, I guess so. I don't know how much debris he was necessarily keeping out of his eyes in this enclosed arena, but nonetheless.
LOD came out in hockey masks. Hockey goalie masks.
Well, this was a very, I would say, low point in the LOD legacy, where they were LOD 2000. They had ditched Sonny by this point, who had brought them back at WrestleMania and added the number 2000 to their name, which doesn't age well, I guess, in 2015.
Not really.
When are the 3000 gimmicks going to start? Will that be in our lifetime? I mean, we're really a long way away from 3000, but it sounds so far in the future that they would age better.
Maybe just be like 2017.
Yeah, we'll get the Y3J problem at some point. There was a big champ for LOD. Give them credit. Bad wrestling didn't mean not over characters. They double-teamed Animal at the start, and then they came back with a double clothesline, and then one from Hawk off the top, as Ross marveled and said, oh, look, a dropkick. High spot here by LOD. Hawk runs shoulder first into the post and gets attacked on the floor, including Ellering kicking him and then being sent into the barricade. Ross suggests that Ellering may have been in a sanitarium all these years, that he had disappeared. But then Ellering trips Hawk, who's running the ropes. They chant LOD with Hawk being beaten down in the opposite corner. Hawk makes a comeback, clotheslines both, and then makes the hot tag to Animal. People pop as Animal enters. They hit the Doomsday Device, but a save is made. Ellering is on the apron, distracting the referee, when Skull and 8-Ball switch places. The early incarnation of Twin Magic. And a DDT is hit, and they cover Animal at 8:51, and DOA prevails.
Wow.
Oh, this fucking match.
Not a good match. I mean,
this was the epitome of the mid-card of the WWF in 1998.
Hawk looked very sloppy, and these twins, I think they both just suck. Animal was probably the best of the four, but I don't think that's saying too much. I also thought Paul Ellering was a little too heavy-handed with his interference at times here, to the point that it just wasn't really acceptably believable.
Then our next segment was Vince McMahon coming out with Sergeant Slaughter, Jerry Briscoe, and Pat Patterson, and they pass by LOD on the way to the ring. And there was a nice little subtle feature here where Vince McMahon awaited someone to fix the steel steps that had been knocked out of position for him to climb up properly. And he gets into the ring. He says if The Undertaker doesn't show up, Vince McMahon is not to blame. Austin nearly decapitated The Undertaker with a chair on Raw and thus provoked The Undertaker and says on everyone's ticket, it says card subject to change. And then he pulls out his reading glasses to read the disclaimer that is in everybody's program about what happens in the event of a no-show and that the promoter himself has the ability to find a suitable substitution and announces that if The Undertaker should not appear, his replacement on this $29.95 pay-per-view would be Steve Lombardi, the Brooklyn Brawler, who comes out, the man behind your weekly pre-tapes in the pre-tape room. The Brooklyn Brawler would get a chance to headline his first WWF pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm. Is he still with the company?
That's what he does. Yeah,
he's still in charge of
the pre-tapes. He runs pre-tapes in the back, and that's his gig.
Okay,
cool. And here in 98, busting out the shirt. I wonder if he brings that shirt to every show, just in the event that they might need him.
They could. It's not a tough shirt to replicate, though. You just cut a few holes.
Oh, but you need the Yankees shirt.
That's true.
I mean, you need the certain logo on it. Then we went to what I feel was one of the highlights of the show.
Yeah, I did too.
I will say
the reason why we chose this show
was the dungeon match.
Yep.
Ken Shamrock, fresh off his loss to Kimbo Slice, taking on Owen Hart in 1998, a fight that is not reflected on the Fight Finder.
No.
But I think if some of those Pancrase fights are acknowledged, they should be on there.
Definitely.
Too.
Definitely.
So. And we had Dan Severn as the guest referee. I assume this was pre-taped in Calgary. I don't feel we were getting a live feed from Calgary.
I don't think they pulled up a truck to the dungeon. I don't think so.
I remembered virtually nothing from this match. So I watched this. I had great enjoyment of this.
I did too.
First of all, Owen Hart for this shoot brought out his Zubaz shorts.
You could
like the ultimate wrestler fight wear.
Like, I feel like you could definitely tell Owen in particular was just having fun here.
Oh,
like,
dude. I think he had turned his brain off.
Yeah.
After all the shit he went through in 97, I think he was just, I don't think he generally enjoyed this product that they were presenting, and he was just going
to
enjoy it.
This match, like, was so ridiculous in concept, and you know what? You're going to come to my childhood home and with a camera crew and film a match? Well, let's just do ridiculous shit.
Then, not to be outdone, Ken did his usual entrance as he walked down the steps to the dungeon, and already, this was 4 stars.
Yeah.
I didn't care what they did after this. I had already been more entertained than anything on the show, like, up to this point.
We're talking no music, you know? Like, just the man walking into somebody's basement doing the Ken Shamrock's yell and scream.
And even the further reference, if you want to go further down, it's the same scene as the fat dude in Wrestling with Shadows walking down the same steps to get stretched by Stu.
Yeah.
The guy with the heavy Canadian accent. Oh, I don't know.
The only thing that would have made this better is if Stu was actually in this.
Oh, that would have been good. Dude, Jim Ross was heavily teasing that the whole Hart family is there. Like, they were telling you, hey, maybe we'll see Brett. Like, they were being heavy-handed about all the Hart family members are home right now.
Yeah.
Meaning you wouldn't know who it's. I could totally have seen Bruce just walk down with some ice cream to sit down. So, Owen gets an immediate takedown.
Let's get some background. How did this even come about? What was going on here?
Oh, these two had been... they had been doing the feud where Owen was teaming with Ken and then turned on Ken to join the Nation. And this was when they were adjusting the Nation of Domination to be just the Nation. And Owen joined and had turned on Ken, and that's how the feud started. And then they had, like, obviously you had the submissions with the sharpshooter, the ankle lock. Dan Severn had been introduced here with the idea of doing something with Severn and Shamrock, but they never really went anywhere with that. Severn did not connect in any way, shape, or form. And it led to, this is where the feud was at this point, after Ken had just won the King of the Ring the prior year. And he was someone, too, that when you look at King of the Rings of someone not really benefiting from it, Shamrock was not one that it did much for. It's not like he was a bust, but he certainly didn't go anywhere. It was kind of just a lateral.
Didn't really seem like it was something that was attached to his identity.
It's kind of like he had won these tournaments, and he won the King of the Ring tournament.
It's another line of tournaments that he's
won. And in actuality, didn't win a UFC tournament.
No, that's true.
I mean, lost the first one to Hoist, and then didn't come back in the third one, and that was the year when Hoist Gracie was injured and he wasn't going to get him in the finals. He just said he wasn't going to continue. That was the Steve Jenham tournament. So anyway, we get back to this one. Shamrock is attacking him and is repeatedly smashing him into the wall. There's a low blow to Shamrock, and then Owen Hart, in his basement, hits a spinning heel kick. When have you ever learned this? Is this in the blue belt curriculum?
No, I don't think so. It might be in the Muay Thai class.
It must be. Lawler cites these audio transmission problems, though everything sounded fine to me. This was far from a TNA Slammiversary broadcast. Owen then smashes Ken's head into the wall and hits a German suplex.
And like for people who've never seen the dungeon, it's really just a small basement.
Yeah, there's nothing glamorous about this thing.
It's a tiny basement with these wooden walls, and you know, if you've seen the Wrestling with Shadows, it looks exactly like that. I mean, there didn't look like there was really any type of padding on the floor. Very minimal.
I will say, Owen, not a very strong guard game in 1998.
No, non-existent.
But had a great transition game from using the pipe over the ceiling to transition into a Hurricane Rana. But then
the water pipe.
Yeah. The water pipe.
He hangs onto the water pipe and does a basic, you know, like a Steven Seagal type of move into a Hurricane
Rana. Of course.
Yeah.
Owen then gets sent into a bunch of barbells. Shamrock hits some knees from the clinch, and then Shamrock uses the water pipe into a head scissors, but it's blocked, and he is power bombed onto the hard floor.
You can't use the water pipe of the man who lives in the house.
This is when Jim Ross thanks all of the Harts for allowing them to use their home. Owen then tosses Shamrock into the pipe on the ceiling and lifts him up through the ceiling, breaking the drywall above.
That was awesome.
They just ruined Stu's television room above, I think. Could you imagine if someone just fell through?
Yeah. The spot was, if you haven't seen this match, which everybody should go out to see, was...
You know
how somebody lifts somebody for like an atomic drop? And basically, Owen did this and Ken's head busts through the ceiling like a cartoon.
So Shamrock responds with a head kick, but misses and takes out Dan Severn. This was his only physical involvement, Dan Severn going down from a head kick.
In a match that was like really billed as, you know, a shoot match here, you got this type of ref bump in the dungeon.
So is Shamrock concerned over taking out his heated rival, Dan Severn? Owen takes a dumbbell and knocks out Shamrock with the dumbbell to the head, applying a crossface, and then Owen uses his own hand to tap Shamrock's out, and Severn declares Owen the winner. And then Owen proclaims he did it all by myself, as Shamrock is left for dead here in the home.
That finish was just hilarious. I mean, first of all, what kind of submission was that? Like, you mentioned crossface, but it was nothing of the sort. It was he loosely grabbed the arm, and then Owen reaching over and, like, just the idea, though, that this was supposed to be a shoot match, and it started off kind of like it. You got to see a lot of Ken's, you know, faux rolling here, and Ken's submission wrestling, in a pro wrestling sense, looks really good. His transitions are really, really nice. But then to go from that to the wackiness of this finish where Owen Hart physically lifts Ken Shamrock's hand to tap and Dan Severn looks at it. Clearly can see all this going on, but then Severn agreeing that this was a tap out anyway. It just went from like somewhat serious to just completely off the cuff, ridiculous. And it was fun.
I will never get tired of mid-90s, like, pro wrestling, but done as like a shoot style of what they believed real fighting would look like in the mid 90s, where it was just everyone throwing out these ideas. And I mean, this certainly wasn't a hardened approach to trying to replicate a shoot fight by any means, but this was so fun.
This is not UWFI.
No.
There were elements of it, but it just kind of broke into partly pro wrestling. But in the end, I just thought they were more going for camp, at least in my opinion. And
I greatly enjoyed this.
It was one of the funnier matches I've seen in a long time, you know, given who the participants were, given the setting, and given just the ridiculous finish, I found it thoroughly entertaining.
Following that was the 2 out of 3 falls match between two, certainly, of the rising stars in the WWF during this summer. The Rock defending the Intercontinental title against Triple H, and this was, of course, the war of the factions at this point with The Nation and DX. They announced it'd be a 30-minute time limit, 1 minute between falls for each to have a rest period. And DX and The Nation, they each come out in the corner but get sent to the back with only China remaining. I guess she's the only one with a manager's license, I guess. This was supposed to be title versus title, but then D'Lo had won the European title on Raw. And early on, Rock ends up taking, delivers a crotch chop in the way towards China, which, was he one of the characters in one of China's movies? Did this get its eventual payoff?
He must have been in the Battle Royal.
So this was prophetic in 1998. There was a big reaction when China forearmed Rock from the floor. And just the idea of China getting involved was people were into it.
Yes.
This Amazon.
I'm sorry. I just had flashbacks to that.
We were here.
I know.
Not a review. I care to remember. They fought on the floor. Hunter gets tossed into the steps. Lots of Rocky sucks chants at this point. And to me, the turning point was the next month after that ladder match, where certainly The Rock established himself, but as did Triple H. I mean, that was the match that I think really set the two apart in terms of becoming kind of the next in line to your Austins and your Takers at that point as kind of the next level of stars. Very slow pace at the start. You got the indication they were going to be going long here. There was a vertical suplex to Hunter delivered onto the floor. Mark Henry returned, splashed Hunter on the floor behind the referee's back, and then Billy Gunn would return to attack Mark Henry, a singles program that was never realized, even after all these years. Rock then hits a belt shot as the referee is distracted with China. So after a Mark Henry splash and a belt shot, does Hunter give up the fall? No, he doesn't. The early days of Hunter were becoming very evident as he kicked out of this belt shot and a splash from the World's Strongest Man. And Lawler then blames China by reciting a quote that I guess was from Jerry Lawler's playbook, saying, quote, "Women, can't live with them, no resale value." Some wonderful messages being sent out to the WWE audience. Lawler asks when the bikini contest is going to start and if you should take his Viagra now or if you should take it later, because now it could kick in. Really begging the question of what Jerry Lawler thought this bikini contest was going to entail for him.
I don't know.
No idea.
Jerry Lawler, JR had a great comeback, though. He's like, oh, if you think you really need it.
They did have some very good interplay with Ross, would just, I mean, the subtle comedy would come through.
Yeah.
With Jim Ross.
Yeah, they're both very quick.
Rock hit this spin around on Hunter and finished with a DDT, which was described as nifty by Jim Ross, but looked completely out of control until he hit this DDT. And then they showed the replay of this, and they just cut out all the bullshit at the beginning and just showed the ending, which was the DDT. The crowd was very quiet for this.
I thought the match was kind of boring.
I did not like this match.
Yeah. Brock's offense here is just very basic, you know, just punching and kicking.
Like, for all we say about Sheamus and Randy Orton, their chemistry together blows this away. Like, this match on Raw today would be just booed out of the building and criticized by people, far less than in 98, where this was considered good.
And we're talking about the match, not the personality.
No, but this particular 30-minute match, yep. where this was a very long match by WWE standards of the time.
Yeah.
So they were given a lot here, and I did not think they delivered. The Godfather then comes out. The Outlaws stop him. Rock just starts flexing his arm neurotically in front of Mike Chioda. And then D'Lo appears, climbs up, gets crotched by Hunter, and then gets tossed to the floor with a belt shot, turns around and takes the Rock Bottom, and the Rock gets the first fall at the 20-minute, 23-second mark. Then hits the People's Elbow in the second fall, getting a two count after the one-minute rest period. D'Lo then climbs back onto the apron, gets attacked by China, and laid out. The referee once again is distracted with China as X-Pac runs in and hits an X-Factor onto the Rock. Hunter then climbs on top and gets a near fall for a big reaction. Then again the referee is distracted as Hunter gets a chair. He's stopped. Rock goes to hit him with the chair. Hunter ducks, takes out the referee with the chair to the back, but then China low blows the Rock and DDTs Rock onto the chair, allowing Hunter to get the second fall in 5 minutes. And then the third fall begins, where Hunter goes for another cover, but there's no referee to count. Earl Hebner runs in for a two count. Finkel announces there's 2 minutes remaining in the time limit, and it finishes with a Samoan drop delivered onto the side of Hunter. He goes into quick falls as time is winding down. A Rock Bottom is blocked. Hunter hits the pedigree, but the bell is called and time has expired. They go to a draw. The fans boo, and China just cannot grasp this concept of the time limit draw. And then the Nation runs in, attacking Hunter. DX makes their return. As Wei said, I didn't think this was a spectacular match in any sense. Mm-mm. And this was not... these two would go on to have many, many more better matches than this. Yeah.
I didn't think the wrestling was good enough here to warrant this match type and a 30-minute draw. I thought it just went really long, and I thought it was kind of boring. You take the personality out of this match, and it just... I don't think it would hold up at all.
Yeah, and the crowd didn't... They weren't very much invested in this match. And, I mean, we've seen examples of, you know, maybe not the best wrestling matches, but the crowds would make up for that. This was not the case. Kevin Kelly then announces to us that The Undertaker has arrived, meaning Steve Lombardi has the night off.
He arrives, and he shows up in his biker gear. This was while he was still, you know, as the evil Taker, but he showed up in like a bandana and looking like a normal person.
Yeah, well, this was kind of the gray area phase. It was pre-ministry, but it was also post-campy dead man. And it was like this amalgamation. They changed his theme music to be like this.
So what were you led to believe? Like, this man is a man playing a character? Is that it?
I mean, they were certainly giving him more of a... I guess human side, that he wasn't just the dead man that did the typical promo voice. He was speaking as himself now, much more, and trying to kind of grow the character during this 98 period.
Before they reverted back.
Like, yes, and then he'd disappear at the end of the year and come back in full getup for the heel run. Then we got, I was watching the VHS version during this part, and we did get some exclusive video footage.
Got it on the network, too.
Oh, was it on there? Okay, well, The Rock was with D'Lo, cutting a promo on Hunter, calling himself the best damn Intercontinental Champion, and he will face Triple H again and make him famous. Which the two did do for one another.
Sure. The whole time I was just looking at D'Lo standing next to The Rock as The Rock cuts this promo, and that head shaking gimmick I thought was just a great touch and added a lot to The Rock.
And made for some great signs that fans would create.
Definitely.
For D'Lo. I mean, that was his most distinguishing period ever, was the chest protector and the head bobbing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I always thought D'Lo was going to have so much more success, and it really hit... just hit a wall in 99, and he never got to a singles level that I thought he was poised for.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the better talents on that undercard.
I thought he played a great sidekick to The Rock here.
Just he was very good. Without, the chemistry with Mark Henry.
Yeah, just even without talking.
Then, how about this for a video package? It was all of the build-up for Sable and Jacqueline. Now, if you have any doubts about the correlation between this period in 1998 and the Impact Wrestling era, where the knockouts every week, it was slut this and whore that. My God, were the seeds planted during this particular time.
This was a Vince Russo screenplay template, I would say, this feud.
Now, this was a point in time where women had never been presented like this in the WWF. You had certainly been pushing it with Sonny, but never as blatant as what they were doing with Sable, where it seemed every week it was an excuse to get her in front of as many eyeballs as possible with as little clothing as possible. Mm-hmm. And it worked. You cannot. You can talk about the taste factor that they were certainly presenting, considering who what their audience makeup was, but there was a giant reaction to this. The thing was, this did wear thin, and the WWF ran with this as their presentation of women for years and years, and TNA did as well, long past it having any kind of effectiveness, and people eventually were turned off by it, where these were not captivating segments of just putting women out there in bikinis. And
it's cheap.
It's a lesson that things can work, but when you overdo them, they lose their effectiveness. As I try.
What would they need to do now if they wanted to play the same card? What would they have to do? What level of extreme would they have to do? I don't know if there is.
I feel that that is a misread of the audience, where
if anything, I feel like people are more looking for subtlety now, you know? Like, I think audiences are probably more seduced by subtlety.
I think people also have a better grasp of how certain genders are presented in wrestling, that I think you do have a much more intelligent audience makeup.
Definitely.
Than some of the audience of 1998, dare I say. Not to stereotype wrestling fans, but I think there is, not to say everybody in this day and age, but I think that there is a more conservative approach by how women are presented. Anyway, that was not the case in 1998, as this video showed. Just as many euphemisms for sexual endurance as you can imagine were delivered here. The term primo real estate body was used. And then Sable asked Jacqueline, when she described her body as primo real estate, Sable asked how often it's rented out.
It was just a
bitch.
It was just such a real cheesy back and forth of just lines that were clearly scripted by a man for these women to say. Skanko, don't just blow it, show it.
She called Jackie a tramp, and Jackie said she doesn't know what Sable's going to do in time for this bikini contest. She could get liposuction, but she wouldn't want to risk the doctor taking the air out of the wrong places. Like, absolute the gutter of scripting here. And then we got our tale of the tape, and what a tale of the tape it was, Way. Everything from butt types to bombs.
Mm-hmm.
The 34 double D's versus the 38 specials. Mm-hmm. And what were the butt types?
The butt types were, for Jacqueline, round and sexy.
Yes.
And for Sable, they were listed as firm and tight.
Okay. So, there we go. This is just utterly ridiculous. Dustin Runnels is then in the ring and asks everyone...
Did you think that you would, on the same day, talk about the UFC Reebok deal on this podcast? But, I mean, you also did a year in review thus far for Fight Network. Do you think that you would talk about that on the same day as you reviewing the Sable and Jackie bikini contest?
Well, I will say that the comments made by Ronda Rousey and the way that Misha Tate and Joanna Jędrzejczyk were presented, a bit of a difference from Sable and Jacqueline in 98.
There's no butt listing in their tale.
Well, funny you should say that. The woman with Reebok who was interviewing Ronda started discussing the issue she had with her bra during, I believe it was the Liz Carmouche fight, and talking about the structure of the new Reebok sports bra. So, I mean, that was about the only overlapping content throughout today's news with this retro review. I do love the contrast of the things we do cover. So Dustin Runnels has everyone bow their head in prayer, asking for forgiveness of these lost souls for what they are about to partake in, and says the Messiah is coming, and you better get ready for him. This was when Dustin was doing the born-again Christian gimmick, which would ultimately result in a retread back to the Goldust character and then into kind of his final Gold Dust run in early 99 before he would leave the company and go back to WCW before many more runs as Gold Dust in the WWE.
It didn't seem like he was getting any type of reaction doing this at all.
No, and then he'd get into a feud with Val Venus with another video with the preacher's wife, with Terry involved.
Mm.
Great stuff at the time. So Jerry Lawler, of course, is hosting the bikini contest and brings each of them out. Jacqueline and Mark Merrill are out first. And then out comes Sable, where, as Lawler says, don't just blow it, show it. As Jackie goes first, and the best way to describe this way is there seemed to be too much Jackie and not enough bikini.
Yes.
As we had a slip on pay-per-view.
Yeah, we had a nipple slip.
Was this on the network?
They blurred it.
Oh, they blurred it. Yeah. They did not on the VHS.
Oh, is that right? Wow. Well, there you go.
So that was, and they did put the sexual warning on the network, so I don't see what the issue was.
This was too intense, Tom.
I guess. This was too hot for TV. Maybe you should have looked up the Springer version of this.
What do you think? Like, you know, kids would be traumatized.
Ross says to set those VCRs. Little did he know about this technology in the network era. Sable takes off her shirt. She comes out wearing her Sable 38 special t-shirt. I can't imagine the men that bought this shirt. However, I can imagine the men that bought this Sable t-shirt.
I can imagine the women who bought this shirt.
Oh, God. She's wearing the same top she had on earlier, and Jerry Lawler is instantly sad about this lack of skin to win.
Yeah.
And Sable says that when she described what she was going to be wearing, she was brought into the office of Vince McMahon, who encouraged her to wear something conservative and has this shirt on and says, this is not her idea of conservative, and people are not watching on a live pay-per-view to see conservative, and that anything can happen. And
boy, we just saw a nipple.
Well, yeah. How is Sable going to top that?
Yeah.
So she says that there is nothing Vince McMahon can do about this, and proceeds to take off her shirt and reveal the handprints over her breasts as Jerry Lawler nearly falls over. A la Steve Bosse this past Saturday night.
Yeah. And he... Nothing else.
He was knocked out.
I was
going to
make a stiff joke. But anyway. Listen, if you're going to hit this tone and this route, I don't think there was a better person to do it than Jerry Lawler. I thought his reactions really... Really,
Kevin Kelly could not have done this.
No way. Lawler's reactions were very good and helped accentuate what they were going for here.
You can't, you can disagree with the direction the WWF was going, but they were going by what the audience was going for, and they were watching these in droves. Now, was it extremely uncomfortable to see this kind of thing with all these kids that you could see in the few rows?
I'll tell you what's uncomfortable is watching this now with my colleagues in at the office.
Like, well, that was your
staring
choice.
Right over my shoulder the whole time. I mean, I'm supposed to be working here, and here I am watching
softcore porn.
This was kind of weird.
Sable was declared the winner. However, I thought Mark Merrow and Jacqueline, very valid that this was not a bikini. And ultimately, as I recall, the decision was reversed the next night on Raw because of that.
What do you mean? What classifies as a bikini?
A top and a bottom.
This was a top?
There wasn't any material.
Sure there was. It was like a tape.
I guess that was the disagreement. Maybe we're going to have to go back and review the Raw the night after at some point. See the fallout.
Has a man ever attempted to replicate this for like a cosplay?
Oh, and with bottoms?
No, just with the handprints.
Oh, with the handprints.
The handprint stickers.
I don't know.
I'm surprised that the dude on Raw, the fan who pulled the shirt up over his head, didn't do this.
You've given someone an idea.
A very funny Halloween costume for some dude.
So then Vince comes out and covers her with his suit jacket and escorts her out. And then we got exclusive footage of Jackie confronting Sable in her dressing room as they are separated by officials and Sable yelling, "Make sure that bitch doesn't come back here." They did convey legitimate anger. Like, when Sable got mad, she really did convey it well.
She called her a bitch.
Yeah.
And a skank hoe.
Oh, Sable used the entire dictionary.
Yeah. You know, if you want to judge this on whether or not they delivered on what they described, they definitely did. You know, if I think any horny 13-year-old who paid for this show probably left satisfied. Probably left satisfied pausing and freeze-framing every single shot for years to come. And, you know, again, this is probably what this show will be most remembered for, that visual.
Lawler, this was not even, like, referenced by Jim Ross nor Jerry Lawler, but you just saw it with your own eyes, which made it more creepy, was that Jerry Lawler stole the shirt that that Sable had come out wearing, and then he still had it when he had sat back at the announce table, and then just tucked it under the desk where God knows where he placed it upon. This is an interesting individual, I will say.
He's playing the horny old man.
I don't know how much playing there was. Go read his book and get back to me. There's a video package for the main event featuring the one-day title reign of Kane, where he won it at the prior pay-per-view after Taker had accidentally, or had he, blasted Steve Austin with a chair in the first blood match. I lost count of how many chair shots there were during this video package, but suffice it to say, a lot. And that took us to our main event, Kane and Mankind against Steve Austin and The Undertaker for the tag titles. They brawled in the aisle, and Taker approached Austin during the entrance. Big reaction, not surprisingly, for Steve Austin. Austin still had his right elbow pad set up. He had been dealing with this severe staph infection for a month at this point. This was crazy. He was working a full schedule with staph in his elbow.
Yeah, that's. I don't think that's safe.
This was, like, reckless.
For anybody
involved. This was crazy that this couldn't have gotten worse. Like, yeah. This guy's changing in locker rooms. I'm sure he was taking preventive measures, but this is staff.
Yeah.
Like, serious shit. Mm-hmm. That in 98, our top draw was not going to be taking time off. Mm-hmm. Austin teases a stunner to Kane early on and then attack him up the aisle. Austin and Taker exchange middle fingers to one another, which were not ring fingers. They were, in fact, middle fingers. Kane then comes in and choke slams The Undertaker. The heels get the heat as Paul Bearer taunts him and just yells, "Damn you to hell!" I loved Paul Bearer at ringside. He was just great. There was a double arm DDT by Mankind, the dirtier deeds. And then Austin makes a save. Crowd just reacted to anything Austin did. It was incredible to watch. Mm-hmm. Austin knocks Mankind off the apron and onto the announce desk and lands like hip first on this announce desk. It is so painful to watch Mankind in 1998. This was 4 weeks after that King of the Ring. And mm-hmm. his body, he was never the same after that match and still going hard.
And I mean, it's hard to criticize him because I don't think he'd be as revered if he didn't do all this stuff. But then again, I feel like so many of these big bumps were just wasted because, you know, they meant nothing in the match.
As much as the Hell in a Cell is remembered, there are dozens and dozens of bumps and chair shots that no one remembers.
Yeah.
That he did routinely during this time period. And man, when we were at WrestleMania this year and you just see this guy walking in the parking lot, I mean, like, the guy walks with a limp now. Mm-hmm. And I don't doubt this guy is in excruciating pain most days when he wakes up. And that's the hard part, to know that this guy has irreparable damage that he has done to himself. And this was one example of it. Taker then drops Mankind on the floor. Kane knocks Taker into the corner. There's a hot tag to Austin, who blasts Kane with a chair shot to the head that Kane kicks out of. Jim Ross just giving that near fall a hell of a call. It was like he was stunned by this.
He's great here.
Very good. Kane and Mankind beat down on Austin. Lawless says Taker is thinking about SummerSlam and enjoying Austin being beaten up, and Ross observes that there are more tags occurring between Kane and Mankind than there are Austin and Taker. I thought both did a very good job in this main event. This was one of the few matches that you could see Ross really get engaged in, that they had a bigger story to tell. Because let's be honest, the undercard didn't give them a whole lot to work with throughout.
I found, like, I think, you know, what really was I noticed about Jim Ross and what's distinguished about him from other commentators is, like, when the match is not that interesting, he would try to make up the storylines to get you interested in the match.
He could take a bad match and incorporate a story that could salvage something.
Or like, point out patterns
yes.
that you might not notice. just from watching the match.
They double-teamed Austin behind Hebner's back. Kane choke-slammed Austin. Then a tombstone was blocked. He comes back with the stunner. Mankind goes for the mandible claw. He takes a stunner. All three are down. Austin reaches for a tag, and Taker is just standing there. And then finally reaches out, makes the tag. Huge fire-up spot as Taker attacks Kane and Mankind. There's a low blow to Mankind. He then choke-slams Kane, choke-slams Mankind, and then finally tombstones Kane and pins him at 17:28. I thought this match peaked perfectly, and this crowd went nuts for this final sequence involving The Undertaker finally helping Austin and just destroying these two. They win the tag titles, but then Taker leaves with both of the titles. Austin is pissed, so you were left with something to be answered the next night on Raw. I thought this main event, it really ended well. Not one of your best main events, but for the standard of the time, it told the story it needed to, and it was the bridge towards the big money, which was SummerSlam next month and the Austin Taker match.
Right, yeah. It was a perfectly suitable bridge between, you know, big shows.
And then our final exclusive footage of the night was the Undertaker walking backstage through many rooms before he finally got to the end, and he kicked the cameraman out of the dressing room.
No, that one I didn't see.
And didn't need to see either. There was very little exclusive here at all. That wrapped up Fully Loaded. Not a memorable show. It had its moments.
Yeah.
But more skippable than must-see.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a show that I think anybody would watch to see great wrestling at. I don't know, you know, a ton of Attitude Era shows that people would go to necessarily watch for the wrestling. But this show didn't really contain any classic matches. I thought most of the wrestling was formulaic. Stars that really weren't stars at the time. And, you know, outside of a handful, I don't even think it's necessarily worth watching for that either. Nothing memorable in The Rock's body of work. Nothing memorable in Triple H's body of work. Nothing memorable in Austin's body of work from this show. You know, if there's anything that I will remember out of this show, it's definitely Sable. And I really found that dungeon match surprisingly entertaining for what it was.
Yeah, I give this show a 4 out of 10. Not a show you ever have to go back and watch, but I had no recollections really of the dungeon match. That was a very fun match to go back and watch. Yeah. Way better than I anticipated going in. So that part was fun. And
I give it a 5.
A 5. All right. Let's go to read some of your feedback, and we'll start off with Brad. Happy Canada Day, hosers. I've got my toque on, back bacon frying up, and just about to crack open a Molson to enjoy Fully Loaded 1998. This was the summer I got back into wrestling, and I can remember all this building to SummerSlam that year, and I loved it. It was a pretty average in-your-house event, and not much standing out. The version of The Undertaker is my all-time favorite, and even the Kane character was fresh at this time. Hope you guys caught a glimpse of Vince Russo in that horrible camera transition in one of the WWF.com segments. I couldn't tell if the dungeon match was filmed all in one take, They Live style, but if it wasn't, the editing was great, a true part of our heritage. Couple of Canadian questions. You guys would have been watching Canadian children's television the same year as I was, and Mr. Dress-Up was my all-time favorite. What about you? What is your favorite Canadian food? My wife is from Quebec, and has introduced me to true authentic poutine and squeaky cheese curds. I can't say I was much a viewer of many children's shows. I've said before, my favorite show as a kid was Today's Special, which was Toronto-based on TVO. But other than that, I watched that and Under the Umbrella Tree.
I'd never watched. I mean, I came here when I was 5 from Hong Kong, so I never watched much Canadian children's TV. I mean, I think a lot of what I remember watching was, you know, more towards like 6 and 7, and therefore a lot of what I watched ended up being American TV on Fox, on, you know, I guess YTV too, but I don't know, your typical. What did I like? Ninja Turtles.
Were there any specific Canadian foods?
Like, what are Canadian foods?
I don't know.
There's no such thing aside from poutine.
Yeah, and I've never had poutine in my life.
Never?
No.
Really?
It doesn't appeal to me.
Oh, okay.
So I can't say that. I can't say there's many Canadian foods. I mean, there are Canadian chains, I guess, like a Tim Hortons.
Yeah, but what's specific about that? Like, what can you get at Tim Hortons that you can't really get elsewhere?
I don't know. So Canadian foods were not the best reviewers of.
Like mayonnaise on French fries, isn't that Canadian?
I have no idea.
Vinegar.
The backpack on one shoulder, is that a Canadian thing?
Wasn't that
a thing on The Simpsons?
Okay, the most Canadian foods include bacon, poutine.
Well, I like bacon.
And maple syrup. But even that's not even exclusively Canadian. Like, Canadian bacon, is that... I think that sucks.
It's a movie.
I mean, just give me real bacon. What else have we got? I'm kind of curious now.
Beaver tail? Have you ever had that?
I've had those.
It's pretty good.
Those are desserts. Yeah. See, some of these things they list as exclusively Canadian, but I could swear you could get elsewhere. Lobster roll, garlic fingers, Nova Scotian donair. Remember those?
Donair.
From Pizza Corner? You didn't have one.
No.
They're all right. Cretons.
Saint Hubert. That's Canadian.
It's just rotisserie chicken, man.
I know that people from the U.S., in particular California, hate Saint Hubert.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How about bannock?
What's bannock? I've heard of bannock. I just don't know what it is.
Bannock is a fried bread and dough food.
I've never had that.
I've never had that either.
What horrible foods Canada has produced.
Yeah, I don't know if Canada's really known for their cuisine, so unfortunate.
Very unfortunate.
What Canada is known for, or at least Toronto, is that it has great cuisine from all around the world. So, you know, we have that.
You know, it's in big supply in Canada. Ribs.
Yes, we are.
Week 3 is coming up. Have we picked a place yet?
Yes, although I don't know if I'll be available this week.
What? What do you have going on Thursday?
I might go to Open Mat.
You might go.
And then I'm going to Two Strikes. Jason Agnew's show. Two Strikes, everybody.
Yes, Thursday night at a comedy bar.
Yeah.
9:30.
So that might interfere, unfortunately.
Boy. Pretty selfish.
Maybe we can move it another night. Maybe Sunday. Oh, we can't do that. Never mind. We'll talk about this off air.
Your turn.
We go to McWhalen, who says, the pay-per-view was during the Russo era, and it shows. The opening matches range from watchable to bad, so I will focus on the three most notable matches. The Owen-Shamrock match was okay, but this was done to set up their superior Lions-Den rematch at SummerSlam. The Rock-Triple H match was decent with too many run-ins, but this was done to set up their superior ladder match at SummerSlam. The main event tag match was fine, but this was done only to further set up Austin Taker for SummerSlam. There seems to be a pattern here. To be brief, this pay-per-view was nothing more than a setup for SummerSlam and to promote Raw. This was common during the Russo era. TV was the main focus, while the pay-per-views, except for the Big Four, were suffered.
We go to Andrew McDonald. It definitely seemed like a run-of-the-mill, in-your-house-style pay-per-view, but I guess you can't just throw all the big matches on every pay-per-view. I will give WWE credit, though, for attempting to save their big matches for pay-per-views like SummerSlam, for instance. On the plus side, WWE business was so hot, they could get away with doing stuff like this. This show was underwhelming, though there were a few things that caught my eye. I felt Paul Ellering was a great manager, despite the team he was put with. He and the Jackal were great, but underused managers that may have had a bigger impact than WWE if they weren't put with such dead acts. My other main observation was how insane the dungeon match was. German suplexes and flat back bumps on the basement floor made me cringe a bit, and it seemed like one of the more violent matches I've seen in a while based on the bumps alone. Anyway, other than that and the infamous painted hands on Sable's boobs, a picture which I fondly remembered as a 12-year-old, the show had a string of bad matches in the middle of the card and really brought down the rating as a whole. I give it 4 out of 10.
We got Ian from Swaffham, England. The Rock and Triple H stole the show in a match that was entered. Everything that went right with the Attitude Era. Solid and hungry young stars, each with a crew of cronies that were certainly over and had the fans eating out of the palm of their hand. However, for the bad part of the Attitude Era, we have to talk about the cold open with Jerry Lawler turning into Eugene at the sight of Sable's breasts to the point that he was still babbling about it while Venus was grinding away. I guess the man had never seen a pair of breasts before that night. Good thing there was a backlit changing screen to help those of us viewing at home. This may have been a show with a porn star making size jokes and a blimp flying around the arena, but in truth, nothing screamed 1998 more than the Lawler Sable segment.
And finally, from David Duffenberg, this show pretty much defines the B-show in that era. It was entertaining, but never seemed to have the must-see feeling. It was a big setup for SummerSlam, which I think was mentioned more than Fully Loaded was. The Lion's Den match was better than I thought it was going to be. Dungeon match. Lion's Den was the next month. They made good use of the limited space they had. The main event told a pretty good story as well. Made me want to go back and watch the episodes of Raw following the show. Austin could do nothing but arm bars and headlocks, and the crowd would still go nuts for everything he does. Seemed like everybody on the roster came out early in some fashion, but it was nice that they saved Austin's appearance till the actual match to get the maximum pop. While watching the Triple H Rock match, it actually made me want to see them at WrestleMania 32. They were two of the biggest names in wrestling at one point, but never had the big WrestleMania match. There was a lot of interference, but the match seemed to benefit from it. Two factions who absolutely hated each other, and their leaders were going at it. Obviously, it makes sense that they all wanted to get involved. It was all paced very well, and it didn't feel like a half hour had passed. And it wasn't a full half hour. I'm sure Pollock had the stopwatch out to let us know. This wasn't a boring show at all, but there was a lot of unnecessary matches. The main matches, though, kept this from being a waste of time. I will give it a 6 out of 10. And those falls, as we went over... 2023 for the first fall, 503 for the second fall, and then they went 227 with the 2 1-minute intervals.
So what's that total?
Oh, I don't add. I just write this. Well, 2023 plus 503 would be 25, 26 plus 227 would be
26 plus... Two, right? 26 and a half plus 2.5, right?
We were at 25, 26.
Okay, 25 and a half plus 2.5?
Plus 2, 27.
2, 27? Okay, so that's 28?
Let's... It was roughly 28. It was pretty damn close. It was in like a second of... Yeah, it was 30 minutes with the intervals.
All right.
So, there you go. They were honest. Okay, well, thanks, folks, for the feedback.
So bad at math.
To Fully Loaded 1998. Next week... We're going to be changing things up. I'm sure there are some that will be ecstatic and others that will not be, but so is life. Next week...
Put on your Reebok gear, everybody.
Yes, we are going to be reviewing the documentary series on Conrad McGregory. it is the Notorious series that many people have requested. This is the documentary series that the Irish broadcaster RTE produced earlier this year, and all 6 episodes are up on Fight Pass, and they are 22-minute episodes. We are going to review all 6 next week.
These are the same people that did the Finn Balor documentary.
Yes, and did a previous special on Conor McGregor. So... Yes, RTE is the broadcaster in Ireland that produced these, and there's a specific tie-in because after next week's review, Wei Ting is off to Las Vegas where you will be covering this fight that we know will involve Conor McGregor, and then will feature either Jose Aldo or Chad Mendes fighting Mr. McGregor. So this is prep for you.
Yes, I mean, I think I would watch this anyway, so this gives me a good excuse. And it's, you know, it's not too often we do MMA reviews, but I think this is a very special case that's deserved because this is supposed to be the biggest fight of the year. We'll see if Aldo actually makes it, but regardless.
This is not a strict MMA review. No. Like, this is a MMA fighter that has tapped into every element of professional wrestling that your most diehard wrestling fan grew up loving characters that spoke in such a way that captivated them to want to see them wrestle. Absolutely. Or fight. And if you don't see the blueprint, you will after these episodes.
Yeah.
So that's what we are reviewing next week. 6 episodes of the Notorious series. Once again, up on Fight Pass, and I'm sure you can find them by other means as well. So that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Review Away. We will be back later this week. We've got Bauer and Pollock, Review and Impact, What's Next, and then The Lost Sunday Night, 11 Eastern. We're going to be joined by Tracy Brooks, who's going to be making her final wrestling appearance ever. She's permanently going to recharge the batteries, but she's letting everyone know ahead of time and not on a live interview with her tag partner. Mm-hmm. At the House of Hardcore event, which is coming up... I guess this month, on July the 18th in Toronto. And also on the show this weekend, we're going to be joined by Ontario independent wrestler Asylum, who you have seen on Raw as Paul Heyman's lawyer. He has also done NXT tryouts, and he's going to be part of the new season of Amazing Race Canada, which debuts next week, along with UFC fighter Elias Theodoro, who's also on the show as a contestant. So we'll chat with him a bit about that and the whole NXT process that he has gone through with a tryout. So that's coming up Sunday night, 11 Eastern on The Law with Jason Agnew and Dan Lavransky. You can check out all of our shows at liveaudiowrestling.com, iTunes. You can subscribe for free, and you can join with everybody in the world at lawradio.proboards.com and get in on the fun conversations that are going on. And if you say something really great, Wei Ting might chime in and share his opinions.
Sure.
Well, Wei, we'll chat with you next week before your big trip to Las Vegas for UFC 189. And we'll be chatting about the Notorious series next week featuring Conor McGregor.
Yes.
That's it. What a fully loaded review to come next week.
Yeah.
That's it.
Great show.
Time to drive off into that sunset.
Thank Tram. Hey, Sable, I got something to tell you, girlfriend. My man, before he met me, been deprived for a very long time.
Oh, Jackie. Honey, you got the story all wrong.
You know, she looked real.
His tank full.
Honey, this body is primo real estate.
How many times have you rented it out?
The difference between you and me is that I'm 100% woman.
Honey, you ain't nothing but a tramp.
Why don't you prove it? Yeah.